It's recording now? Yeah, my name is Seaburn J. Buckaloo, Jr.
Mm-hmm. Where were you born?
I was born in Dallas, Texas, on the 6th day of December, 1920. Uh-huh. And I came to Alaska in the first part of April of 1950.
Between 1920 and 1950? Where did you get your education?
Well, I lived most of the time in Dallas, Texas. And then we moved. Then I went to grade school in Dallas. And then my father was an engineer, and we moved to Chicago. And that must have been 19. That was during the Depression. And so I went to grade school for a year or two, finished grade school in Chicago on the north side, and went one semester to Senn High School.
What high school?
Senn, I think it was S-E-N-N, Senn High School in Chicago. And then moved back to Texas, finished high school in 1938, and I went to what was then known as Texas A&M College, which is a university now, but I went to that great land-grant college at College Station and graduated and went in the Army in 1942 and got out of the Army in 46 and kind of dribbled around, went to law school, and finally graduated from Stetson University in DeLand, Florida, Stetson University Law School. And got admitted to the Florida bar, and they had a good job in Florida, but I didn't really know where I wanted to go. Well, I was going to school, and then I was looking for a job, and I decided I didn't want to stay in Florida. And of course, then I had to get admitted. So I got admitted. And then I was thinking about, of all things I was thinking about, my wife kind of wanted, we were thinking about Alaska and Hawaii. My wife had been a Navy nurse at stationed at Aiea Heights.
How do you spell that?
I don't know how you spell it. Aiea Heights. But which was right out, right now, we finally found where the Navy hospital used to be when we went back there. But probably, I was leaning more toward Alaska. It was just one of those things you wanted to do. And besides that, you could drive up. Mm-hmm. Well, I had a car and we drove up here. Then I started to work for Stan McCutcheon. And then I was here about not quite 11 months, and the Korean War started, and I went back on active duty for about 11 months. Got out of the service and went in the U.S. Attorney's office as an assistant U.S. attorney. Judge Cooper was the United States Attorney, Earl Cooper.
Can we just backtrack a little bit to about 1942? You went in the Army for the first time out of undergraduate school. What did you major in undergraduate?
In undergraduate, I started off as a pre-med, and I'm like pre-med. And I got a BA degree with a major in history and a minor in economics. Mm-hmm. And I switched, I think my second year. Anyway, my grandfather was a doctor. Mm-hmm. I don't know, somebody thought I ought to be a doctor, but I didn't have that much interest in being a doctor.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother that's 2.5 years younger than I am. There's only two of us.
Mm-hmm. What does he do?
He's some kind of a physicist, a nuclear physicist, and he's worked for the Sandia Corporation for years, and he lives in S-A-N-D-I-A, Sandia, it's named after, but anyway, I guess they make weapons and have something to do with power plants and nuclear power plants. But he's worked for that company for, I don't know, 35 years, I guess. And that's where he lives.
Where?
Albuquerque.
When you went into the Army, what did you go in as?
Went in as a private. I was rejected for ROTC because I had a visual acuity of less than 2400. So I was slightly nearsighted. But then as the war progressed, they changed the rules, and I went to officer candidate school. And once I got a commission, I stayed in the reserves, and you know, finally retired from the National Guard some 35 years later.
What was your final commission?
That was a temporary brigadier general, state and permanent colonel. It means that that went on the retired list as a colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm drawing retired pay now because I'm over 60. But, and I enjoyed the military part of it anyway.
Did you ever think of making a career in it?
Not really. I was really thinking about going to law school. I started thinking about law school, I guess my third year in college. And then I wasn't sure I was going in the Army because there was one suggestion I might be 4F. The only thing wrong with me was that I had poor vision, but it's correctable to 20/20, and that created some problems for me. They changed the rules then shortly after that.
What made you want to go to law school?
I was kind of interested in government, and I took a course at A&M in business law. Been so long ago, and I took another course and had something to do with the law. And I liked it. Yeah, I liked the professor was a lawyer, and he's kind of had a lot of charisma, and he was a popular guy. And he tried cases around Madisonville and College Station, so he was kind of a well-known local guy. I can't think of his name now. And when I was in the Army, I decided that I was going to go to law school. And so I went to law school. And I'm glad I went to law school. So I've enjoyed it. And I enjoy being a judge. I enjoy being a trial judge. And at times I really enjoyed trying cases when I was a lawyer. But I would say that I enjoy being a judge probably as much as anything I've ever done. And I'm fortunate because I don't want to be an appellate judge. And it's not a lack of ambition. It's just that I think I've got a better job than the people on the Supreme Court, those on the Intermediate Appellate Court. So,
what do you like about being a judge? What about
I guess it's kind of egotistical. I think I'm qualified to be a trial judge, and I think I've had enough experience to where most of the time I make pretty good judgment calls. And I realize now that I wouldn't have been qualified. I'd come on the bench when I was 35 or 40. And that's what impresses me about the Alaska judiciary is a pretty young judiciary. We got judges around here that are 35 or 40 that are real, real surprisingly good judges. But that wouldn't have been for me. I wasn't ready to do something like that when I was that age. So, and I was interested, of course, in a territorial government. And I got interested in the statehood movement as soon as I came up here.
The judges that were here when you first came up, what kind of people were them? Can you compare them to the judges that you obviously know?
Well, the judges that, when I came up, of course, my first contact was with Judge Diamond. Mm-hmm. And he was the only, it was a single court. And he handled everything. And they'd bring Judge Fulta up from, or when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I used to ask that Judge Fulta come up because, you know, it was to, I thought it was to, I thought it was to the government's interest because he made it easier for a prosecutor to try a case. And Judge Diamond, was kind of, I thought he was an outstanding jurist, but he was an older, you know, I thought he was an older man. When I was at the Constitutional Convention in 55, I even thought that a man should retire from the bench at age 60, because at that time 60 seemed like a, you know, like fellows on his last should be carrying around an oxygen bottle or something. And now I've only been on the bench not quite 10 years, and I'm going to be 62 in not too many days, December 6. So 62 looks pretty young to me. And of course, when I see Wendell Kay, he looks young to me. But so I don't see many folks that look old to me anymore. They all look young, but no, not very many old folks. Oh yeah, that was well. Some of the things that I think about Stan McCutcheon, he was, but anyway, we went sheep hunting, and we forded the Matanuska River, which is extremely dangerous. I wouldn't even think about it now, but we forded the Matanuska River. Right at the where Caribou Creek enters the Matanuska River, which is about a mile 110 on the highway, but it was real hot weather, and Judge Fulta reminded me in some ways of a Marine sergeant, and he at that time he must have been, I don't know, maybe 55, I guess, but he could walk halfway run 30, 35 miles at a time, I guess. And Bert Biss and I were young. Bert was younger than I was, but he was fatter than I was. And the judge really gave us a bad time about slowing down. But we never did get a shot at a sheep. And we came back, and the river, the Matanuska River, probably because of the warm weather, raised probably swollen a couple of inches, and I didn't think it was safe to ford the river, but the judge insisted on it, and we were going to use the same method. Of course, we had packs, rifles, and we had a long pole, and the judge was the toughest one, I guess, so he was the first man on the pole against the current. And anyway, disaster struck. The judge collapsed, and Bert and I together got the judge out of the river. All three of us nearly drowned. But a couple of days later, we were in town, and Stan McCutcheon ran into me. And he was a great actor, but he says, "You lousy, what's wrong with you? Drag that guy out of the water." He says, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard of. But I can remember once this same judge, Judge Fulta, I guess at that time I was probably the United States attorney, but I prosecuted a young ex-soldier by the name of Randall. Anyway, it went up on appeal, United States versus Randall. And the trial was kind of a circus, but anyway, McCutcheon was representing him, and Mr. Randall had gotten obviously intoxicated, and he had a little tiny Beretta automatic, little 25 caliber automatic. And of course in those days he was charged with assault with a dangerous weapon. He pointed the Beretta at the bartender in one of the local pubs. But anyway, he goes into the pub and he's drunk, and the bartender, for some strange reason, didn't want to serve him. That's the first time I ever heard of it. If you were drunk, some bartender wouldn't serve you the drink if you had any money. But anyway, Randall had money, and the bartender wouldn't serve him, so he whips out his little Beretta and orders a double scotch, and of course he got it immediately. But anyway, he drank his double scotch, and he goes out and gets in his car, and his little gun went off, and he shot a hole through his hand. And Dr. O'Malley was a treating physician. I guess he was on emergency duty or something. But I called, and my star witness was Dr. O'Malley. But I called O'Malley as my witness and asked O'Malley to describe their wound. Of course, it was a jury trial, and Dr. O'Malley starts off by describing the wound. It's a pencil-like wound, and he said I'd say that wound was caused by a 25 caliber bullet, probably one that came out of a Beretta. But anyway, Stan was really objecting to that. But Stan McCutcheon had a great big hand, and I had a witness that was sitting next to Mr. Randall in the bar. And he testified that he could see the clip was in the gun. And that was circumstantial evidence that the gun was loaded. No, anyway, I had this guy testify, yeah, I saw the bottom of that gun. But anyway, Mr. McCutcheon repeatedly picked this Beretta up in his hand. He'd wave his hand at the jury. He couldn't even see the gun, much less the clip. But anyway, when I argued the case to the jury, I referred to his paw, which was like a bear, and then the defendant, Randall, had a little skinny hand. It wasn't appropriate to even give any consideration to that demonstration. But anyway, Randall was convicted. But at time of sentencing, I've never seen a performance like McCutcheon put on. And you got to remember that Judge Fulta was, he was really, really tough in criminal cases, really tough in sentencing, tough during the trial. But Mr. McCutcheon gets up and goes into this long harangue, and Mr. Randall had been a sergeant in the American Army, and he had received a Silver Star, and he had been with the advanced infantry unit that seized the Remagen Bridge. And Mr. McCutcheon starts off on this long story. And I'm watching the judge. And I can see that he's listening to this nonsense too carefully. And McCutcheon is demonstrating. He says that some French general, he's got 450 tanks, and he wants to know if Randall is secured. Sergeant Randall got that bridge secured yet. And then Stanley goes on and he says there's this infantry division, this tank division, and General Eisenhower sitting back at the big headquarters wanting to know how Randall's doing with that bridge. And finally, Randall secures the Remagen Bridge, and Stanley says, and those tanks roll into Germany. Those soldiers roll into Germany. My client is the one that made all that possible. And this United States attorney wants to send him to jail. And then he said, Eisenhower, somebody pinned a silver star on him. And General de Gaulle gave him that Croix de Guerre, and he said somebody else wanted to give him a medal, but I can't remember who it was. But he got a pretty lenient sentence. He'd been in trouble before, but they were, some of those lawyers in those days made pretty colorful defenses. You know, you listen. I can't. It's been so long ago, but I can remember I was prosecuting. I think it was me. I was prosecuting some defendant for some kind of vehicular manslaughter. I don't know whether it was true or not. But Wendell was the defense attorney. Then I'm out in the hall, and I thought everything's going great. And juror number 12. Wendell told him he was a good friend of his. And he said, he'd be a good juror, but I said, why is that? He says, oh, hell, he said, I got him acquitted 9 months ago on the same kind of charge. He'll be good. He understands these kind of things. And anyway, part of the facts were that the guy was operating. I can't remember what the results were. But it seemed like in those days, in the 50s, it was a pretty free and easy going. Not the practice of criminal law was substantially different. I've seen Renfrew, for example, be appointed on a case and then go to trial that afternoon and do a good job. And so it just things happen real quickly. And Judge Diamond, you know, he had good control of his courtroom, but you could go a long ways before he cut you down. But it was just different. But I can remember when Grigsby was one of the leading trial lawyers, and he was an old man when I was here. But now that I think about it, he didn't look that old. He looked like a vigorous old man. I think he'd been in the Spanish-American War. But he had all kinds of tales. But he was a tremendous trial lawyer. And he and Diamond were about the same age. But he did so many things I can't even remember now. But I can remember one Saturday morning, we had some kind of a bankruptcy matter. And the United States was involved in it some way, and I was there representing the United States. And there were about six or seven lawyers from Seattle. And they looked different than the lawyers from Alaska. Saturday morning, people were going, doing this or that. And a lot of the lawyers just had on wool shirts. And then the judge indicated that Friday, the proceedings had to deal with it. Had something to do with a bunch of creditors, and we were trying to make some kind of agreement. But anyway, the judge says, and we'll be informal on Saturday morning. We'll start at 9 o'clock, and we'll be through by noon or whatever it was. But Grigsby is there representing somebody, and he has on a suit and a tie. He kind of almost looked like one of the Seattle lawyers. But all of a sudden, he reaches in. He gets his cigarette, he's looking for a match, and he lights his cigarette. And there's no ashtrays, of course, in the courtroom. And Judge Diamond is just, he's so shocked. He doesn't know, he just watched it, and Grigsby lights up his cigarette. And of course, these attorneys from Seattle are waiting for the judge to have the marshal put him in jail. But anyway, the judge, a very kindly boy, said, Mr. Grigsby, he said, I know I told you we were going to be informal today, but we're not going to be this informal. Would you put the cigarette out, please? And that's all he said. And Mr. Grigsby stood up. He said, yes, Your Honor, and he put the cigarette out. That's all that was said about the cigarette. But they had a lot of lawyers in those days that were good, good legislators, you know. And, like in the 55 legislature, I don't know how many lawyers were in the House. Wendell was the Speaker, Stan McCutcheon was in the House, Pete Calmaritas was in the House, Judge Plummer was in the House, I think Judge Gilbert was in the House, Tom Stewart was in the House, Burke Riley, who was a lawyer, I don't know where Burke was practicing, maybe in Haines or someplace, and George McNabb. There were just, there must have been 20 lawyers. And when you look, when I look back at the session laws, then we didn't have any staff or anything like that. You know, you went up in the library and drafted your own bills. And of course, out of that legislature came the Constitutional Convention bill. And the lawyers are ones that dominated the House, and Wendell and McCutcheon and Calmaritas and the rest of us really put together the Constitutional Convention bill.
Can you tell me a little bit about
Calmaritas? Well, he, we always referred to him as the Golden Greek, but I think part of the reason, kind of respectfully, he had a reputation of being able to collect his fees, so we always referred to him as the Golden Greek. But Pete had probably more to do with the Integrated Bar Act, as I recall. I can't even remember. I think I was on the Judiciary Committee, but I was in the Enrollment and Grossman Committee, which had, I can't remember exactly what we had to do. I had to do with keeping track of the bills and seeing that they got to the Senate. It was kind of the first term. People, how I ended up with that, I don't know. But Pete worked on that integrated bar bill, I think, probably more than any of us. And, the bar had been having problems with Jerry Williams of one kind or another, and they wanted... They just wanted to get the same status that bar associations had all over the country, control their own membership and that sort of thing. And in those days, I can remember even at John Mansey, even at his funeral, his memorial in the court, Jerry Williams gave part of the eulogy and admitted on the record that he had the questions and answers before the exam and was complaining about he didn't get a score of 100. But so there were a lot of reasons that the bar took over the management, and not management, but discipline and management of their own affairs. And of course, in the Constitutional Convention, the organized bar is mentioned, because in the judicial article, so I think my recollection is that there's a provision that the organized bar shall be polled on judicial candidates. So at that time, the bar, they just got it, but they did have legal status and the Board of Governors and so forth. But I'd say that Judge Calmaritas was the man that did the journeyman work and followed it through and talked to the senators. Of course, we all did, but he's the one.
Why did he take such an
interest? He was interested in it. He was handling the applications for the bar. He just took over and. That's the way it went. I don't know whether Pete was ever on the Board of Governors or not. Might not have been.
Was there younger members of the bar, people who came in about 60, say that there were still attempts to keep the bar small? Do you remember that sort of thing?
Yeah, there was. I was... for a long time I was on the the board of examiners or whatever, people that graded the bar. But anyway, we didn't have that many applications. But Dr. Raybach was the chairman of the committee who graded the papers for years. But I don't know how many times I served. But Dr. Raybach is kind of like a walking restatement. You know, he can quote everything. And actually, he was extremely well qualified for grading papers. But I can remember on more than one occasion being not criticized, but jumped on by my fellow lawyers because admitted too many. You know, 35 people took the exam. We might pass 30 of them or 29 of them, and that caused some rumbles from some of the members of the bar. But I don't remember anybody on the committee. And then usually they brought somebody else in from maybe Fairbanks or Juneau, and there's three of us. And now I don't know when that was. That must have been that. That was probably before and after statehood. We got statehood when January 3rd, 1959. But the committee didn't, and I know when a candidate came within a point or two, we'd regrade that paper. And then Dr. Raybach would, you know, philosophize, well, this candidate looks like he's got enough knowledge to practice law. And so that candidate would get in. Didn't associate with too many. I was, when we went on that trip, I don't know whether I was in private practice or not, but I might not have been. I went into private practice in October of 1953. And that's probably November 1st, 1953. I left the U.S. Attorney's Office at the end of October 1953. So that, I was probably still with the Justice Department. And Bert Biss had been his law clerk or something. And I don't ever recall Judge Fulton going on with any defense attorney. No, I'd say he wasn't that open, no.
What about Judge Diamond? Was he pretty open with attorneys?
Oh, yeah. I thought he was. And, of course, my recollection is from his history, he'd been a delegate to Congress, and he'd been a lawyer and practiced in Valdez and Cordova and Anchorage, and he was really interested in government, and as I recall, he was, you know, a good Democrat, and he was, you know, he was reserved, as I guess all federal judges are, and but yeah, you could talk to him. Mm-hmm. And he was interested in everything that was going on. He was interested in what's going on in the legislature. He was interested in what's going on with the bar. And was really a loss. I can remember when he died. But, you know, this town was pretty sad because a lot of people really missed him. It was a small town, friendly town. And most of the people, maybe, you know, you might not know their name, but you'd recognize them, you'd seen them someplace. And in those days, a lot of the lawyers spent a great deal of time at Merrimack when Patty Kassane was running it, because you know, when you'd go out for a jury, why you'd go to the Merrimack.
How do you spell her last name?
You know, it's Patty Kassane. I think it's C-A-S-I-N-E. Patrick Kassane. But he's an Irish fellow. And he ran the kind of bar that he didn't like any prostitutes in there. And he was a good practicing Catholic. Went to Mass before he opened his bar and that sort of thing. Judge Diamond went to Mass before he opened court. But he was delightful, and it was a pleasant place to go. And the lawyers, and then a lot of the FBI people. Now I'm talking about the early 50s used to go over there. I don't know what they do now. But the FBI office, I don't even know how many people are in the FBI office now. But it was at that time, I don't think there was over 4 or 5. And of course, I worked with them when I was in the Justice Department. But, Grigsby used to go over there and hold court and tell tales. Just walked in and asked for a job.
Was it the first person you walked in on, or had you asked around?
And he was the first one I asked. But now, you got people, I don't ever remember anybody presenting resumes in the 50s, they might have. And now they tell me that they want to know where you went to law school, and some law schools on the East Coast, you might get a preference. You hear that if you went to Harvard or some other place, you get a preference with the appellate court, with the Supreme Court. Well, that's a fact or not, I don't know. But in the early days of Alaska, of course, Grigsby, I don't think, graduated from law school, and Stan McCutcheon didn't. And he probably understood evidence and trial tactics and what was relevant and what would persuade a jury to see a case his way. He's probably as good as anybody. He never did go to law school. And I guess, in the West, particularly the Western states, where they always had the clerkships, and that's the way a lot of these people came along. I don't think Judge Diamond was, neither was Judge Fulta. Judge Fulta never, I saw a bibliography once and just had a one-liner, he was a federal judge and born on a certain date. That's all it said. That's all the information he gave out. But of course, these judges up here weren't, constitutional judges like, we have once we got to be a state. They had 4-year terms. So, territorial judges.
Who are the other people practicing when you came up?
Oh, I can remember, Davis and Renfrew were around, and John Hughes and McCutcheon and Nesbitt, and Harold Stringer. George Grigsby, and Jerry Williams, of course, was the Attorney General, and I know I'm leaving people out.
John Manners.
Oh yeah, John. I hadn't thought about John Manners in a long time.
What was he like?
He was real opinionated. He was a skilled lawyer. Did anything in the world to stay out of court. And once he got into court, though, you never knew what was going to happen to you. But if they ever got him into court, he was usually ready to go. But he had a pretty extensive practice. And he was opposed to statehood, and he was the advocate for Commonwealth, and he didn't like to pay, nobody does, but John didn't think federal income taxes were constitutional. But as I recall my conversations with John Manders, everything the government did, as far as I remember, was unconstitutional. And he could talk for 40 minutes and just about convince you, yeah, that is unconstitutional. But he's a good public speaker, distinguished looking man, and of course it seems like a lot more business, particularly I guess lawyers that were trying cases, a lot of things were settled over in the Merrimack and other places, which I don't, of course I had to, I don't go in bars anymore, just, I guess because I'm a judge, but in those days we spent a lot of time after 5, 4:30, and as I say, we had a jury out, you went to, I can remember poor Judge Hodge. He was practicing law in Cordova when I got here, but he was a federal judge here. I think that must have been after he was, I remember he had the hives or some kind of skin problem. Real terrible. And I was trying to, that was after statehood, I was defending some fellow for perjury, and anyway, I got a judgment of acquittal from Judge Hodge, but he was really irritated, irritable during his trial. I mean, he's still courteous and very considerate man. But the second day of the trial, I went over to the Merrimack, and they had kind of like, I don't know what they call them, pasties, what they had, some kind of meat pie thing, you know, like the Welsh miners. But anyway, Patrick had a little oven. You can go over and get one of those things and a free cup of coffee, but that's where I went to get my lunch. And I'm sitting down there eating my little sandwich, and I looked up, and Judge Hodge was down at the other end. So I finished my sandwich and I walked down there, and then I realized that the judge had a shot of whiskey in front of him. And he was really embarrassed. And I made some flippant remark, are we going back to court today? And he said, yes, we're going back to court today. But then he had a suit on, and then he showed me he had on a white shirt. And he had scratched himself so much that the blood was coming through his shirt. And I forgot what kind of skin disorder he had. But I called it hives. He might have called it something else. But anyway, he said that he'd been to see his doctor. Doctor said, well, hell, try. You got to finish that trial. He said, have a couple of shots of whiskey. He said, if that helps you. Judd said, that helped me. So, but he said, I'm all right. But anyway, he went back. But I never did see Judge Diamond in a bar. And that's the only time I ever saw Walter Hodge in a bar either. But I'd say that the practice of law was pretty delightful. And of course, then we had when I was in private practice, and Wendell and I were partners for a brief time in 55 or 56, but that didn't work out. I was gone to the Constitutional Convention and going to the legislature, and neither one of us were ever there.
Is that a big problem with lawyers? There were so many that were in politics.
Yeah, but it was problems for sole practitioners, and it was a real problem if you had a real small firm. Both of them were in politics. It didn't work out very well. And in those days, I don't think anybody really thought too much about building law firms and getting a structured operation going. They started thinking about that, I guess, in the late 50s. And I just kind of like being a sole practitioner. You know, I've read those studies from the American Bar Association. They tell you that's not the way to do it. That's not the economical way to practice law. And so the sole practitioner is kind of like the prairie dog, I guess. It's vanishing from the scene. We don't have many sole practitioners here anymore. We've got some pretty small firms, though, two or three-man firm. But now you're getting firms up here with I don't know how many. I see lawyers every day. Papers come through here, and I don't recognize their names. But we must have, I don't know, what, we got 900 lawyers in Anchorage? See, and we're I don't know, I guess in the early 50s, there was probably less than 50, maybe less than 35 in the early 50s. And of course, J.L. McCary was practicing here. Of course, he was a territorial judge, too. There's all kinds of stories about Judge McCary. But you got to remember that he was the only judge up here. And it really was. And he hadn't had any experience with the criminal law. And there's a lot of funny stories that occurred. But I can remember, which was a real advantage to my client. Wendell was representing a fellow by the name of Salazar on a robbery charge. There were two defendants. The other defendant's name was Garner. And I would just walk in the back of the courtroom to watch Wendell select the jury, and they are already in the process of selecting the jury, and it's discovered that Mr. Garner doesn't have a lawyer. So I'm appointed. The judge looks up and he sees me and he appoints me, and I move for continuance, and well, he denies the continuance. Then I get up again, and all this nonsense is on the record. I get up again and say something about I need another minute of the court's time. You gotta point out my client to me. And I went to trial, and then I realized that the defense was an alibi. So I moved for a continuance when I came back from lunch on the grounds that, which was true, I'd been running all over trying to find these witnesses that probably didn't exist anyway, but I couldn't find them. But I didn't have much time to find them anyway. But anyway, Salazar and Garner were convicted, and I told Wendell, I said, gee whiz, I think even the Ninth Circuit's going to say that I probably didn't have enough time to get ready. But I filed some kind of simple application, I don't know whether it was 2255, something, and made some kind of direct petition, and they vacated his conviction. So Garner got off, and Salazar got, I don't know, 12 years. But I told Wendell, I said, gee, I think I got a good point on this. I just don't think I had enough time. I don't really think that's going to fly. But it's surprising. I think the caliber of the trials that I participated in and the trials that I observed in the 50s and early 60s, some of them were well tried, all kinds of cases, civil and criminal. So even in the 50s, they had a lot of talent in the bar. A lot of able trial attorneys, like a fellow like McCutcheon and Wendell could, they measure up the trial bar anywhere. And Grigsby, of course, was, even though he was old, was still a master.
Did you ever have a case against Grigsby?
Yeah, I tried some against him when I was in the U.S. Attorney's office. He kind of I had pretty good luck with as a prosecutor, but my recollection is that Grigsby skinned me pretty bad one time. I can't even remember. It's unpleasant. I should have won the case, and I put it way back in my mind someplace, and I can't remember the details. But I remember he took me on a case that I planned on winning, but I had been successful against. Well, you know, some of you get strong cases, and defense attorney can't do much about it except go to trial and hope that he's going to get a ringer somewhere.
When you worked with McCutcheon, with Bill Nesbitt?
Yeah, he was there.
He was there at the same time. What was he like when you first got here?
Yeah, he was a rough and tumble lawyer. And he changed considerably after he got on the bench. Because he was the first Chief Justice. And he kind of changed things. I guess maybe he had to change things. Because we were pretty loose and careless about a lot of things. But once he became Chief Justice, after a while, he kind of ruled that court system with an iron hand. And then they only had a three-judge court. And you hear criticism that he pretty much dominated that court. And it's kind of tragic, too. I can't think of the judge's name now. It's Harry Aaron. Signed that order, which was, as I recall, was going to require prepayment of jury fees in civil cases. Those judges on that court got 10-year terms, and I often wondered why Harry was the one that signed the order. He wasn't the Chief Justice. And my conscience still bothers me because I wrote all my clients letters and said, don't vote for that guy. He's taking jury trials away from you. Send him a copy of the order. And we got a constitutional right to a jury trial, and only the rich people are going to get it. But I guess all the lawyers, most of the lawyers in the state, wrote their clients, contacted people, and he went down. And then you realize lawyers had a strong voice in those days. And I guess if you're a client and your lawyer writes and says, don't vote for this fella, you're going to take one of your constitutional rights away from you. You're going to dilute it. He's going to think about that a while and probably follow your advice. He follows your advice on other things. So. And he got beat at the polls. And Nesbitt, he had already been elected. He wasn't running. And he's the one that should have signed the order. Why it happened that way, I don't know. Never talked to Nesbitt about it. I did write Nesbitt a letter when the Supreme Court was first organized, but he didn't answer that letter. I told him that it never occurred to me, and I don't think any delegates at the Constitutional Convention and a three-person Supreme Court would be geographically split as ours appeared going to be split, one judge in Anchorage, one in Juneau, and one in Fairbanks. You always think, these appellate courts, you get a multi-person court. The theory is that these people can get together and sit down in the quiet away from all the turmoil and talk to each other and make decisions, the three of them. I think we got a good Supreme Court. I think it'd been a lot better court if they had to all go to Juneau, that's where they have to go, or all go to Anchorage. But actually, I think all these judges should reside here if this is where the court's going to be. But now they've got, you know, they got this thing about geography, and you can make an application to a single justice in your own community and so forth.
Separate places.
Well, it came about because the governor appointed them, I guess, on the geography had something to do with their appointment. And then Judge Diamond, the one to live in Juneau. And, this was Harry. Who was on the original court?
The original one was Hodge and Diamond. And wasn't Hodge on the
Hodge was on the original court, I think. And then Harry came on because...
The federal court.
So that was a mistake. But, you know, it's one of those things. And I think it cost us a lot of money.
There was a convention in Nome in 1959, maybe I think it was that year, where the Board of Governors of the Bar got together and set up who would be the Bar's nominees to the Judicial Council. Remember?
Where was this?
In Nome. And I think people were upset that the people who had been elected to the board, elected to become part of the Judicial Council from the bar, were Harold Stringer and Bob Parrish and Ernie Bailey. I think those were the original.
I think that's right. Those are the people. I don't think I was at Nome. I don't know whether I was in the state. Might have been out of the state for some reason. But I don't know about that lineup. There, I remember criticism about it.
Yeah. And Stringer was replaced by Plummer, like Judge Plummer. I think that was the... Do you remember that hearing about that the first judges were picked or selected as far as plaintiffs and defense? There was an effort to keep a balance.
Yeah, I heard some. I heard some discussion about that. Mm-hmm. And but Egan was pretty independent. Of course, the names came from the council, so. And yeah, I was interested in the selection process, but I didn't apply, and they didn't pay much money. Mm-hmm. I think trial judges got $15,000-$16,000 a year. I think that's what it was, and so. But they had a lot of good candidates. I can't even remember the original. I think Judge Fitzgerald, Davis, and maybe, was it Earl Cooper? Because I took Cooper's place in the Senate. And I sat next to Judge Moody in the Senate. I was trying to think, we got into an argument once. I almost thought we were going to have a fist fight on the floor of the Senate. I can't remember what it's about. I can't remember what the argument was about. But I think he indicated he might whoop me. But passed pretty quick, but I don't remember what all the ruckus was about. Nothing I said to him. Jerked his chain about something. Yeah, because Judge Moody was... Oh, yeah, Moody was around. Have you talked to Moody yet, Judge Moody? And he was the Attorney General. He'd been on the... Was Judge Moody the second Attorney General?
I think so, after Rader.
And then he came to this court from the Attorney General's office. Oh yeah, I was dissatisfied with that judicial council because I can remember I applied once or twice for the Superior Court. I think I got, and I did well on the bar poll. And I got two votes, I think, out of the council. But there were old political arguments that we'd had, one kind or another. Wendell's name didn't go up one time. And I know he was first on the bar poll, and he might have got three votes. I don't think it took four, but neither one of our names went to the governor. And I didn't have, and if there was a, I can't even remember how many times I applied. But if there was a Republican governor, they'd send my name up. Of course, you know, I'm going to get appointed. But if Egan was in, they couldn't get through. So, yeah, it was kind of sad that they didn't send Wendell's name up.
Why didn't they?
I saw it, and that's factual. I remember reading an article that Wendell wrote in the Bar Rag. But Wendell and I were rooming together, and what was that senator's name? Warner from Seward. Real nice fellow. But he didn't believe in workman's compensation. He was a Democrat. He believed if a workman cut his hand off, he was negligent. And he wouldn't even need to pay him any compensation, even if the saw was defective, known to the employer. But we had some kind of bill that strengthen the benefits and so forth, which we were interested in. Wendell and I roomed together in the Menden Hall. We were on the fifth floor. And it was kind of like a Greyhound bus stop. People coming and going all hours of the night. And you know, we always had a cache of whiskey there, kind of an open bar. Didn't cost any money. So we had a lot of visitors. But Wendell and I got into an argument with Warner, Senator Warner. And Wendell says, if we pitched him out this window, he'd drop five floors on his head. He'd be just as knothead as he is now. He says, let's throw him out the window. So we grabbed a hold of him. Man, no intentions of throwing him out the window, but that's how the story got started. We didn't throw him out the window. But at the council, I hear that from, I guess Mike Stepovich told me that when my name went up, they said, oh, that guy's dangerous. He said that. They're talking about me, and they must have said the same thing about Wendell. He should have been indicted for attempted murder. You don't want him on the bench. But That's what Wendell's talking about. And actually, there wasn't anything to it, but
was it drinking too? Was it that he drank in the early years?
That's probably yeah.
Was the judicial council really concerned about that sort of thing?
I'm sure they might have been. So it might not. That could have been a. Wendell would have been, you know, Wendell had the reputation of a heavy drinker. Mm-hmm. I mean, that'd hurt you. It'd probably hurt you with a council. I can't think of, he was pretty much, he got a little pamphlet. There's somebody picked up a pamphlet one time on a study of judicial selection. They had an article on the history of our judicial council, but I haven't seen it in years. But I remember going through it, and it listed all the candidates, how many times the judge applied, and so forth. I can't even remember how many times I applied. before I was appointed, but I think I'd get to look like a real loser. But I don't think it made, I don't think how many times you applied if you did all right on the bar poll and you didn't have any obvious disability, I don't think that makes any difference.
What made the difference? I mean, why did you finally get through?
Probably the last time I probably really wanted the job, and before, just, you know, I didn't do anything, just sent my name in. And this time, I, you know, I talked to a few people, told them I really wanted the job, ready to go on the bench. And the time, Wendell applied for the Supreme Court, but his drinking shouldn't have been a valid issue then. And I think Wendell probably drinks a little now, I don't know, but pretty limited. But
did it hurt him in his early years, the drinking? Did it hurt him as a lawyer?
Well, it'd be pretty hard to tell. I doubt it. I didn't hurt him as a legislator. Mm-hmm. And when that legislature was a pretty hard drinking legislature, it wasn't just Wendell, like McNeely, I forgot about Bob, but he's the only one that, and it's a matter of record, but he was drunk probably the first 40 days of the session. And we got his wife up there. Kim brought her to Juneau. But he had a good legal mind. He's a good legislator. He had a terrific sense of humor because after his wife got there, of course, he sobered up. And his first speech was that he was going to change his vote or change his position on some bill. I forgot now what it was. But he started off by saying, on sober reflection. And the people in the gallery just clapped, you know. And it wasn't anything that anybody hid. But here he was, and everybody knew his wife's there, and he's ready to do business now.
There were a number of disciplinary cases in the 1950s, the Springer case, the Bell case, the Shaw case.
Well, I was involved.
Why? All of these cases, was that usual?
It was unusual, The Bell thing got started. I was prosecuting some defendant for forgery, and they had a little glass door in the old courthouse. They had a little small courtroom over there. I was prosecuting some guy for a forgery, and I left my file in there in a recess, and Mr. Bell might have been, he was charged with something. But anyway, the marshal looked through there and saw him going through my file. And my forged instrument was gone. So that was kind of the basis of that. But I don't know whether there's anything to it or not. And
what happened with the case?
I think it was eventually thrown out. We never did find the forged instrument. But the marshal was a guy by the name of, he went to Arkansas as a prison warden, Tom Merton. Mm-hmm. But Merton used to wear cowboy boots, and he dressed like a cowhand. But I remember I was prosecuting a case, and Stanley was the defense attorney, and I told Merton to get rid of the cowboy boots and dress like everybody else. And he came in, he really looked pretty good. And then McCutcheon come. It's a juror's New Merton, you know, and he referred to him. I had him dressed like little Roy Fauntleroy, and the jury thought, oh, gosh, that's funny. Did have him dressed a little like Lord Fauntleroy. But Merton's the one that went down to Arkansas, and he was the warden. They dug up all those people and all the prisoners and the graves. And he's written an article on prison reform. But he was the same Tom Merton, but he was a deputy U.S. Marshal. And I think Stringer was charged with, I don't remember exactly what he was charged with, overreaching client. And there was problems with Stringer at times, and making an appearance, not making an appearance, but in those days, everything, there was a lot of cases, not many prosecutors, and plea bargaining was kind of rampant. And one or two attorneys had the bad habit of starting plea bargain and find out the case is going to be tried, and then they weren't there and they'd never made an appearance. And I did put a stop to that when I was in the U.S. Attorney's office. I wouldn't talk to them until I made a written appearance. So I know that if we didn't strike a bargain, they were going to be there to try the case. Man,
so what they do is come and see if you were
going to
prosecute, and if you weren't going to prosecute,
well,
they could
fee. But if you were, if they could make a bargain, you know, well then they go back. I guess they'd take their money then, and they never did. They never had to get ready for trial, mm-hmm. I assume that maybe you could. Maybe you could make a bundle of money and do it in 30 minutes. And whether all that was factual or not, I don't know. But we didn't. I forgot the defendant's name. The guy that complained against Stringer. I know we had some problems. I was U.S. attorney, and Talbot was working for me. And I wanted to interview this guy, Kemp, and Talbot indicated that if I obstructed justice or something, that something might happen to me, and they indicted Stringer, and I didn't have a chance to, interview the Kemp or whatever his name was. And Kemp wasn't a very good witness, so I never did think they had a good case, the United States had a good case against Stringer. But Dave did have some complaints that maybe he had talked to Dave and hadn't made an appearance. But that practice was terminated pretty suddenly.
So the practice of being able to go talk to the district attorneys and bargain without putting
it in a scare? Oh, some, you know, like you take a... it was limited to a very few lawyers, you know, like Wendell Kay came over and talked to you about a case. Never occurred to you to have him make an appearance. Mm-hmm. Lots of attorneys come over and talk to you, and they say, well, I represent this guy. Well, I don't think we ever thought about a written appearance. And I guess the rules certainly provided for it. We didn't do it up here, but we started doing it. Mm-hmm. And now, here, I guess you routinely, you know, when I was practicing, I always entered an appearance. Written appearance. But things were a little different.
The U.S. attorney was a political position. Did you have to go?
No, you had to go through the rigmarole. Of course, they had four U.S. attorneys. They had one at Nome and Gino and here and in Fairbanks.
Who were the U.S. attorneys?
I think I was ahead of Stevens.
Okay.
because Stevens came after me. I remember when Stevens was up there, he went on a raid with a drawn gun or something, but I remember all that. Maybe that's when Wendell referred to him as Teddy Bear, I don't know.
So Stevens had a vigilante reputation?
He's kind of a, yeah. He was, they raided a house of ill repute or something, and he was along. And whether he was armed or not, I don't know. When he got down here, first he had a pistol, and later on he had a submachine gun. And now it might have been a bazooka if you talk to somebody. But he went on the raid, and maybe he was the commander of the task force. I don't know. But
when was the last time they did something like that in Anchorage? Did the U.S. attorney ever go out on?
I never did go out on anything, but I don't think I was in the U.S. I'd left the U.S. attorney's office. I remember Chenoweth raided the Elks Club for some kind of a gambling thing, but I don't know.
When was that?
That had to been 55 or 56, maybe. But that was a big rhubarb over that. You had a couple of old-timers sitting up there playing cards. But that case went away. I don't know what happened to it. But Chenoweth is the same one that gave Wendell a balance test.
Oh, in McCary's
courtroom? Yeah, I guess they told you about it. Somebody must have told you about that.
Go ahead and tell me about it.
But anyway, Wendell was trying a case, and Judge McCary apparently thought he smelled whiskey on his breath. Early in the morning, Wendell was sober, but anyway, he thought he might have smelled whiskey on him. So he called the United States, Deputy United States Marshal, Chenoweth. Chenoweth took Wendell downstairs. The jury knows all this is going on. You know, they were pretty sympathetic, because I'm sure they could tell he was sober. But anyway, Chenoweth took him down, gave him a bunch of balance tests, and brought him back up and told the judge he was sober as a judge. And they went on with the trial. But as it turned out, it probably worked to Wendell's advantage. And he, you know, didn't appear to bother Wendell at all. Might have upset him if he'd been drunk, but he wasn't drunk, so... So there he was, pure as the driven snow, sober, sober as a judge.
Tell me a little bit about Renfrew.
Renfrew was a real character, and he was a able trial lawyer. Could think, he had a real quick mind, integrate a set of facts and analyze them in a matter of, seemed like, seconds, and see what direction the wind was blowing and run with it. And he was lots of fun in court, and he could be nasty and kind of violent at times in his mannerisms, but kind of like a little banty rooster. But I can remember, and he did funny things. I can remember when they had a call of the calendar and the defendants didn't have, and all the lawyers had to be there. If you had a case pending in the court, everybody had some kind of case pending somewhere, you had to be there for the call of the calendar. And Judge McCary appointed Renfrew to represent some poor guy. And the judge had just appointed him, and Renfrew leaps up and he said, "Your Honor, we're going to plead guilty." And McCary observed that he hadn't talked to his client. "It don't make any difference. We're ready to plead guilty." And his client looking around like, "What the hell's going on? I'm not going to let you plead him guilty now. You got to talk to him first." "I don't want to talk to him. It's the kind of nut stuff, you know." But then he'd sit down, everybody'd snicker, and they'd go on with a calendar call. But you couldn't get away with things like that now, I don't think. And But they were, and surprising what defenses that I can remember helped prosecuting, I should say, because we had a sergeant, used to be a sergeant by the name of Kenneth O'Hara, and he had a wife whose name was Audrey Richardson O'Hara. But anyway, Sergeant O'Hara started a bus line, 1943 or 44, and running the soldiers from Fort Rich into Anchorage. And the highest income he ever reported was like $11,000. And he accumulated, I don't know, $1.5 million worth of property. He had a bus line running all the way to Fairbanks and owned lodges up the road. He made a barrel of money, but he didn't manage it right. And anyway, the government, and he was broke, and he lost it all. But anyway, the government charged him with tax fraud, and they sent all these hotshot investigators up. And Judge Diamond appointed John Rader to represent, I don't know whether he represented Ms. O'Hara or Mr. O'Hara, and Roger Cremo represented the other one. And the Justice Department sent a guy up by the name of Wolven Patton to help me prosecute this guy. And he had barrels and barrels of documents. And Rader and Cremo just drove us crazy with objection. Gosh, it went on for weeks. They were court appointed, you know. They objected to everything. And then we finally got all the evidence in. Well, how much it cost to prosecute those people, I don't know. And then they made a big plea to the court, and Judge Diamond gave the sergeant 30 days in jail. And we spent about $200,000 prosecuting them. And I don't think Ms. O'Hara got any time at all. They didn't have any defense. We had two sets of books, you know. And by the fraud man came by, and they had two fraud guys up here. That's when they were still going. And they, you know, they suspected them a long time, because you look at those tax returns, and they net worthed him, you know. He went from a net worth of $4,000 to $1.5 million, and the highest income he reported was $11,000. That's kind of suspicious. Did that in a short period of time. But this first agent goes by and asks Ms. O'Hara for the books. She gives him a set of books. But the first agent didn't know that the second agent was supposed to pick the books up. So the second agent comes back, and the sergeant's there. He asked for the books, and he couldn't find them. And then he found the dummy set of books and gave them to the second agent. So the two agents get back to their office, and they both got a set of books. And then they open them up, and they see that one, they had a true set, and one was a fraudulent set. But in my final argument, I thought it was a perfectly good argument, but I started arguing to the jury that I referred to Sergeant O'Hara as a $1 million sergeant or the $1 million corporal. Objection! The judge chewed me out in front of the jury. Don't do that, Mr. Buckley. So I figured these guys are not going to get much out of it. But it was amazing the amount of time that those guys put into the case. They really worked on it. And they lost, and we won. We got a conviction. And the judge imposed a big fine. But, you know, all they have to do is sign a pauper's oath, and that wipes that fine out. You know, it's bad. So that's where. No, I don't think so. I think probably the way they got appointed, I wasn't the U.S. attorney. Earl Cooper was the U.S. attorney because he was talking to Ms. O'Hara or somebody, and Cremor or Rader wasn't there, and oh gosh, they went crazy. Unauthorized communique was kind of bad. But what he was talking to her about, I don't know. But that was it was kind of a strange case. And this Mr. Patton, who was an attorney in Seattle now, a very successful attorney, handles tax cases, but he was originally from Georgia. And he was tall, distinguished looking. You know, like a Southern colonel, real polite, and Judge Diamond really liked him. But he's the one that got all us. And then we just had barrels and bundles of exhibits, tax returns, and all kinds of documents. And you imagine all the junk you have to get in to build a case on the net worth somebody. But that case might have taken 5-6 weeks to try. And these guys were court appointed. And I think they probably got, you'd have to ask them. He might have got $200 from the court. Maybe $300, I don't know.
Where did you go after you left the U.S. Attorney's office?
Went down 4th Avenue and opened an office. So Billings, yeah. And ran for the legislature and got elected. And ran again and went to the Constitutional Convention.
What happened to your practice while you were running for office?
It kind of disappeared. Well, it wasn't a very wise thing to do. But I enjoyed it. Just built it up when I came back. Mm-hmm. And it seems like I spent an awful lot of time with politics, and I was in the National Guard, and have to go to camp in the summer. But you couldn't survive in today's environment running a law practice like that. Because now these, you know, lawyers didn't default you, and it was pretty pleasant way to make a living. I'm sure it probably is still pleasant, but I see cases where I think the lawyers, you know, make all kinds of motions, and they probably wouldn't have to make them. Pick up a phone call, ask for something, probably give it to you. And that's a little different.
The last time you were in the legislature, was that in 59?
59, and that was the end of it.
Then what did you do?
Practice law. Then I got tired of practicing law, and I went in as a district attorney in 1971. Mm-hmm. I stayed there till I was appointed to the bench. I was only there about 2 years. I came on as a judge in July 9th or 10th of 1973. So.
Did you practice with anybody besides McCutcheon and
Houston? And Judge Tucker and I were partners for a while. And I shared space. Well, Virgil Bohaska was up there, but I had an extra office, and Virgil was there for a brief period of time. But most of the time, I was just on my own.
In the early years, you could do both politics and practice. Do you think that you would have been content just practicing like you almost have to do now? If you want to make a living, you can't be a solo practitioner and get involved.
I don't think it would have been as rewarding. I really enjoyed being in the legislature. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of motivation. The territory didn't have any money, and we were being taken advantage of. You know, we should have been a state. And even in those days, we realized this country had great potential. a lot of wealth that might come out of the ground and come from somewhere, and we better be a state. Otherwise, somebody else is going to be running all this. And that was a real good idea to have a constitutional convention. It was even a better idea to adopt that Alaska-Tennessee plan, which really didn't come from anybody in this state. It came from a gentleman from Louisiana. What was his name? He had a French name. George Lee Lightner. George came up to the Constitutional Convention and addressed the convention and told us we ought to do what they did in Tennessee. And he was just interested in the admission of Hawaii and Alaska because he didn't think it was fair. And so he came up and gave a Rip Snorton speech and said we ought to elect two senators and a congressman and send them down there. Tell them to stay there to get a seat. Words to that effect. It was which we did. And that's the reason I think we got a better constitution than the other states, better than Hawaii, just because we drafted it when nobody paid that much attention to us. So it was really done almost in an academic vacuum.
How did the DA's office change when you were there in the 70s versus when you were there? The 20-year difference.
It was a lot different. It's more structured, more cases, more the you know, criminal, more motions, and more appeals. I don't remember, but about 6 or 7, maybe 10 cases being appealed in 2 years I was there, 2.5 years I was there, and. And I don't remember how many were reversed, maybe 1 or 2. But of course, you got a different situation when you go to the Ninth Circuit, because you know historically those federal district judges are very seldom reversed, and they're not that much brighter or knowledgeable than any of the judges around here. It's you got more of a brethren look at things than we have here. Actually, I suspect that Alaska's court system is probably as good as you'll find in any of the states. Probably is as good or better. Of course, the public probably doesn't agree with me, but you talk to some of these judges in the other states, and we got some good things going for us up here.